This is Sportsnet Today with Logan Gordon on your official home of the Flames, Sportsnet 960 The Fan.
Rolling on to hour two of the program. It is Sportsnet Today. Logan Gordon along with you from the Doug Lacey's Basement Systems downtown studios here in sunny Calgary, Alberta, Canada. Cam and Taylor, my outstanding production team, over in the other room. Cam reminiscing about Slurpees in the break.
I think I'll go get one during our next break.
Why don't you do that? First hour of the program filled with lots of NHL talk in reaction to the Edmonton Oilers falling short in their six-game series against the Vegas Golden Knights after a 5-2 loss in game number six. Reed Wilkins from 630 Chet at the road in Edmonton with some reaction. Called it one of the more disappointing years for the Edmonton Oilers, given all the accomplishments they had, what Connor gave them this year. Fact they were able to go out, pick up a guy like Matthias Ekholm, and only to be thwarted by the Golden Knights in round two. Interesting to see what happens with the Oilers as the offseason continues. And one of the points that Reed brought up is one that's come over the last couple of days, and that's the status of their general manager as the Oilers perhaps look to transition former Flame and Oiler defenseman Steve Staios perhaps into the GM role to take over for Ken Holland. That would potentially make both Alberta teams making changes when it comes to the general manager post. You know all too well about what's happened in Calgary. GM Brad Treliving and the team mutually part ways. The head coach is fired a week later after a review by interim GM and president of hockey operations, Don Maloney. And still we sit here on this May 15th with no GM for the Calgary Flames. A loose timeline presented by Don Maloney following the NHL's draft lottery show, saying we have a meeting coming up with scouts, obviously, ahead of the NHL draft in a couple of weeks. We'd love to have a GM in place by then, but as we speak to you right now, there is no GM in Calgary, and who that is clearly still in the works because both the NHL insiders I mentioned there, Frank Saravalli and our NHL insider from Sportsnet, Hockey Night in Canada, Elliot Friedman, with news on this Monday, or I shouldn't say news, maybe see more of an update when it comes to candidates and where the GM search is at for the Calgary Flames. Here's a bit of Friedman from the latest 32 Thoughts podcast on the Flames and their ongoing GM search.
Believe the Flames are headed into phase two of Operation GM, which is narrowing down the list and bringing some people in for interviews. I think some of the people they've talked to, I've heard Mark Bergevin's name. You know, I've mentioned Mark Hunter before that I thought he was going to at least be on their list. Another person I've wondered about is Ray Whitney. He has a history with Don Maloney, and I've kind of wondered about that. But one thing that a couple of people warned me was, actually I shouldn't say warned, but they said made me aware of, is don't discount the internal candidates. You know, one of them obviously is Craig Conroy. I've also wondered about the possibility of Brad Paschal.
That is Elliot Friedman. Part of the 32 Thoughts podcast. You can catch it in its entirety wherever you get your favorite podcast. But, of course, throwing out a couple of names there. A couple that we've heard before. Obviously, the internal candidates of Conroy and Paschal, who I think, obviously, given the work that they've both put into the Flames organization, shouldn't surprise anyone that they're still around. Mark Hunter, a name that has been thrown out by Friedman before, Interesting that he notes Mark Bergevin in that conversation, Ray Whitney as well. And to wrap this back around to Frank Saravalli, our NHL insider from Daily Faceoff, who joins Pat on Flames Talk and the guys on the Big Show with Russick and Rose, he tweeted out this morning, hearing Flames plan to pursue permission to interview Leafs assistant GM Brandon Pridham for their GM vacancy. So throw another name into the hat for the Calgary Flames. So if you were to say that all of the names that we've mentioned here from Friedman and Saravalli are still internal candidate, are still legitimate candidates for the job, if those are the only names, and I'm sure there's probably more, you're still looking at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 names on the list. And those are the ones that we've heard of. So to say that there are more out there that the insiders probably haven't gotten a hold of as far as names go, I think would be a fair assumption. So you're looking at, as Elliot phrased it, phase two of Operation GM, narrowing down the list of candidates. Well, as of today, the candidates that we've heard people attach to this team are still at 6. That's a very interesting list to me, because it tells me that, yes, the list is definitely narrowing down from its initial search, which I'm sure was and clearly has been wide-ranging for Don Maloney, but still nowhere near, at least in my mind, when I hear at least 6 candidates, it tells me you're still working your way through a pretty long list. And that's, to me, very interesting, because it kind of gives you an idea for timelines, how this thing is looking, who's, you know, going to come in for perhaps second interviews, who's going to be, you know, some of those guys that they're going through. So obviously the name today that's made a lot of noise has been Leafs GM Brandon Pridham. He is the Leafs salary cap and collective bargaining agreement expert. He's involved in a lot of contract negotiations for the Leafs. Certainly fits the bill of younger, progressive thinking GM that we heard from Don Maloney after Brad Treliving's dismissal. And it's interesting because those were the words that he brought up, but not all of those names have always felt like they fit that mold, with all due respect to Mark Hunter and some of the others, you know, that we've heard on this list. I don't know that all of them fit into the younger, progressive, new thinking GM that we heard from Don Maloney that they wanted to hire. Pridham was hired by the Leafs back in May of 2018, with Kyle Dubas announcing that he'd be promoting him to assistant GM. He joined the Leafs as an assistant to the GM in August of 2014. Salary cap analysis, contract negotiations, collective bargaining agreement interpretation for the team. Dubas has called him a vital part of the organization, earning that title. Pridham joined the Leafs after working for the NHL, where he served as a senior director, central registry, and senior advisor for central scouting. Began his career at the NHL in 1999 as a coordinator in NHL Central Scouting, and 15 years with the league, served in a number of capacities with them, and now all the way up to assistant GM with the Toronto Maple Leafs. So a heavy background in scouting, CBA, salary cap negotiations, all that sort of stuff. I would say a guy that probably checks a lot of boxes if you're a Calgary Flames fan and you're looking for a new voice to come in, somebody that's going to, you know, certainly understand the role from a couple of different angles because of his, you know, long history with the team. And look, the Toronto Maple Leafs playoff failures aside, if you were to look at his, Brandon Pridham's time with the team, have created some great contracts. They've signed some massive free agents. They've done some good things when it comes to drafting and finding different ways about things. So I can't sit here and tell you that I know everything about Brandon Pridham and that I think he's heads or tails above any of the other candidates. I think it's certainly a very interesting resume and one that would fit what Don Maloney's talked about. Curious to see if the Leafs, we hear more about whether or not the Leafs decide to give the Flames that permission. They've kind of got their own situation going on today. If you've checked Twitter for any amount of time or you're keeping up with locker room cleanout for the Toronto Maple Leafs today, you'll know that Kyle Dubas hasn't exactly staked his claim as the GM of the Leafs going forward in the long term. He said today, paraphrasing obviously, that it's a family decision right now for him whether or not he's going to commit to the Leafs. He's either going to be with the Leafs as their GM or he's going to take some time to recalibrate on the season. Said he won't be popping up next week anywhere else. He can put that to bed. He's not, you know, looking to jump ship to a different organization as soon as his tenure with the Leafs ends. So from a Toronto perspective, it might be a difficult time to pass off one of your assistant GMs who's got a very strong background like Brandon does and say, yeah, go ahead and interview with Toronto, or excuse me, go ahead and interview with Calgary, potentially take their GM job when, who knows, he might be an internal candidate for the Leafs should Kyle Dubas decide that he's not coming back to be the GM of the Leafs. And based on what we've heard today, that doesn't sound like it's set in stone one way or the other. So perhaps the Leafs take a bit to cover their tails in that situation. We'll see what comes of that. We'll see if Frank has any more reporting on that situation as the days go on. But some of those other names to dive into as well from Friedman, obviously the internal candidates, Conroy and Pascal, we know about them. Mark Bergevin was an interesting name to hear come from Elliot Friedman, former GM of the Montreal Canadiens. Taylor, have you ever heard of Mark Bergevin?
Nah, no? Never in my life. No? Who's that?
Yes, that figures. He is 57 years old now, former pro hockey player, of course. He's currently sitting in a senior advisor role to the GM of the Los Angeles Kings in Rob Blake. So if you were wondering where Mark Bergevin landed post-time in Montreal, he has gone to the other side of the continent in California and been spending time with the LA Kings as a senior advisor to Rob Blake. We've seen him plenty of times, actually passed along in the Scotiabank Stadium in the press box almost every time that the Kings are in town. So Mark Bergevin has been right around it, stayed in hockey. Again, it's interesting to hear because does Mark Bergevin strike anyone as young, progressive thinker that Don Maloney seemingly targeted or wanted to target as this team's next GM? I'm not saying he's a bad GM. I'm not saying that at all. I think he had time with the Montreal Canadiens and different things were successful for him during his tenure there. Other things were not. And going, you know, coaching, all that sort of stuff seemed to be a bit of a back and forth for him. Obviously a long playing career, which some people value as a GM position for sure. But again, at 57, I don't know that he strikes me as that sort of young new thinker for the Calgary Flames in the GM spot. If you were going to go to a Bergevin, I would almost, you know, probably pivot and say, okay, well, I think just given the internal candidates, what they've done and what they know about the organization, I would much rather, I think, talk about a Conroy or a Pascal if that was the other way to go. Mark Hunter, that's a name that we've heard before. We've talked about his tenure before, and Ray Whitney, one of the other new names that Friedge has brought up in this, obviously knows Don Maloney well from his time in the league, has always been respected as a great thinker in the NHL, one of the premier undersized scorers in his time in the league, and someone that I think for a couple years now you've heard as somebody that has wanted to get into more of a management role with the with an NHL team, and that would be an interesting one to see come to fruition if that's somebody that is in fact in place for the Calgary Flames when it comes to their GM search. What do you remember of Bergevin as GM, Taylor? Because you follow the Habs closer than anyone here. I didn't think he was a bad GM.
I think in Montreal he just kind of ran his course, where he wasn't really bringing in a lot of the young guys, right? Like, he still had Weber, Price, other players that I completely forget now. But then you have Kent Hughes, who's the current GM, and he's bringing in guys like Kirby Dach and Sam Montembeault, and you're finally kind of seeing this change and getting younger. But Bergeron fully just ran his course there.
Yeah, and that to me is an interesting one, because I think, you know, if you look back on it, and I'm just trying to find the exact date. Okay, so May 2nd, 2012, he was named GM and executive vice president of the Habs. He would wind up being fired on November 28th, 2021. So he spends almost 10 years as GM of the Montreal Canadiens. That's a very long time for any GM. We're just talking about a guy here in Calgary like Brad Treliving. So almost the exact tenure that Brad Treliving was here, Marc Bergevin was there in Montreal. It didn't take him long. Just about 2.5 months later, he was hired to that role that he has currently with the LA Kings as their senior advisor to the GM. Now, the Flames would have some internal knowledge of Marc Bergevin in the form of Kirk Muller, who was hired as an associate coach in 2016 and spent a lot of time in that organization. So for the Flames to ask for a little bit of an internal scouting report from somebody that would know Mark and his day-to-day pretty well, I think Kirk Muller would be a guy that you would absolutely lean on if you're the Calgary Flames. And look, has experience with the position, has scouting experience. He was a scout with the Blackhawks for a couple of years, was an assistant coach with the Blackhawks for a few years, and was with them when they won the Stanley Cup in 2010. So, again, a pretty long resume from Marc Bergevin. But like I said, now 57. Like I said, not a bad GM candidate. I wonder again where the list comes down to those young progressive thinkers that we've wondered so much about for the Calgary Flames. Brandon Pridham, assistant GM of the Leafs, probably fits that bill a little bit more. And look, probably a first-time GM, I think, would be somebody that talks about a new thinking, or someone that hasn't had a chance to hold the reins. Pascal and Conroy both fit into that book as well. We'll see. It's just interesting now that the weeks have gone on a bit. Friedman says they're into step number two, or part two of the GM process, narrowing down the list, and we've got at least six names. Is there more than that for the Toronto or for the Calgary Flames? Absolutely. Curious to see what kind of timing this leaves them with the draft just a few weeks away. We'll take a break, come back on the other side. That's the latest on the Calgary Flames in their GM search. Pascal, Conroy, Bergevin, Hunter, Ray Whitney, all names thrown out by Elliot Friedman on the 32 Thoughts podcast. Reminder, you can listen to that wherever you get your favorite podcast. And the update from Frank Saravalli of Daily Faceoff, our NHL insider here on Sportsnet 960, that the Flames are expected to pursue permission to interview Leafs assistant GM Brandon Pridham for their GM vacancy. But again, a bit up in the air with that one, given the news that Kyle Dubas said today that it's a family decision whether or not he plans to commit to the Leafs, and didn't make it clear whether or not he would be coming back or not as the Leafs GM. So that might put a bit of a wrinkle into the Flames asking to get permission to interview Pridham if the Leafs GM change happens as well. Again, you can catch that 32 Thoughts podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Friedman and Merrick pumping them out all throughout the NHL's playoffs and the offseason for many teams. I'll take a break, come back on the other side. We'll talk some Toronto Blue Jays around the corner. It's a game day for the Jays. They take on the New York Yankees, looking to win their fourth in a row after a very successful weekend against one of the top teams in the NL. They sweep away the Braves over the weekend. Good signs for the Toronto Blue Jays. We'll check in with Shoh Ali from Sportsnet 590 The Fan in Toronto. That's next here on Sportsnet 960 The Fan.
You're listening to Sportsnet Today with Logan Gordon on the home of the Flames, Sportsnet 960 The Fan.
The pitch, swing and a ground ball towards the hole, base hit into left field. Vladdy scores to tie the game. Here comes Chapman to win it. The Blue Jays win it on Danny Jansen's two-run base hit in the bottom of the ninth.
Ben Wagner on the call. The Sportsnet Radio Network, Jays 6, Braves 5, Danny Jansen walks them off, bring out the brooms as the Jays sweep away one of the best teams in the NL. Nice little Mother's Day present for all the Jays moms out there, and what a great statement win for the Toronto Blue Jays. 3 in a row over Atlanta, now getting set to welcome in the New York Yankees for a series in Toronto. Welcome back to Sportsnet Today. It's Logan Gordon along with you. Very happy to continue the hour by going down the Atlas Pizza and Sports Bar guest hotline to chat all things Toronto Blue Jays with our pal Show Ali from Sportsnet 590 The Fan in Toronto. Jays talk, Jays pregame, host, producer, you know him, you love him. Show, thanks for doing this as always, man. How are you?
Good, Logan. How's it going?
We're doing great, man. Probably not as good as the Jays are. Great series win wrap up. I liked how John Schneider put it. It wasn't pretty at times, but the Jays found a way to get it done against a very good Atlanta team all weekend long.
Hey, yeah, you put it best. The Atlanta is easily one of the best teams in the NL, and maybe at times it didn't look like it. And as someone who watches a lot of Jays, I admit I don't watch a ton of the rest of the NL, but the Atlanta team is a team that just went to the World Series a handful of years ago, and they're still an extremely dangerous team. So for the Jays to, honestly, I was thinking before the series started, had they won one of the Spencer Strider, Bryce Elder starts and lost the other, I think I wouldn't have been too disappointed because those two guys have been so good. But they won both, and then they managed to overcome, boy, that game on Sunday, a game in which I think they just burned the game tape from. I think everyone burns the game tape except for Danny Jansen right at the end.
Yeah, fair enough. And it's interesting to hear because, you know, throughout the series they had different, you know, whether it was base running or defensive errors, you know, those things happen in baseball, Show. But I think a real positive sign, and I think you would agree with this, has been their bounce back from those moments this year and really showing a very mature mindset when it comes to having those errors happen and being able to stick with it throughout a ball game and continue, even if it isn't easy, you know, pushing and like they did against Atlanta in a lot of times, coming back to have wins and not let those mistakes decide the games.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think there were a lot of moments yesterday where they could have easily folded after some of their own errors occurred. And there are a lot of moments yesterday where they didn't capitalize on many errors from Atlanta, especially out there in the outfield and basically every part of the outfield, left, center, and right. But you're right. They have shown a lot this season, a different approach at the plate. And I think you used the word mature or maturity. And I think that's the perfect word for this team because they are, like, I think we saw a lot last year, them swinging out of their shoes, you know, to try and hit, you know, 5-run home runs effectively sometimes. And this year we're seeing a whole lot less of that. We're seeing them take a lot of patient approaches. They're not expanding the zone at the plate. It's been really rewarding, I think, for a lot of Jays fans to see after what you got to see in 21 and 22. So I think the makeup of the team is a teensy bit different. They have some more left-handed bats in the lineup as well. So I think they are taking what the pitchers are giving them and, you know, quote unquote, using small ball to win, manufacturing runs, getting guys, you know, taking the single and getting on base and working some timely walks as well, which we saw in the bottom of the ninth as well yesterday. So it's definitely a refreshing change so far here on May 15th.
It's still early on in the season, Show, but how important is it, do you see, for this team having early success at home and how much that could matter down the stretch for them?
Oh, I think it's hugely important, right? Because if you think about it, here on May 15th, there haven't been that many home games, right? Like, if you think about the entire schedule to date, they have played, I believe, a third of the entire year's road schedule already. in the first, like, just a little over a month of the season, which is absolutely crazy when you think about how many games you play in a single season. So that they have played a third of the road schedule already and have come out in our 24-16 through 40 games, I think you feel great about where the team is, knowing that they have been able to win a whole chunk of their home games already, like you're saying, and then also have a whole whack of home games still to come. And don't get me wrong, this upcoming stretch, there's a four-game set that starts tonight against the Yankees. There's a three-gamer against the Baltimore Orioles, also at Rogers Center. And then they're going to be on the road to take on the Rays for four, the best team in probably all of Major League Baseball. So a very AL East heavy schedule. And most of those games are at the Rogers Center. So you want to think the home field advantage can help them. But between now and the end of the season, there's a lot of home games left. And the friendly, renovated confines of Rogers Center, I think, will be definitely a boon to the Blue Jays.
One thing that some of those home fans got to see, a pretty rare appearance for any pitcher nowadays, that's a complete game and a complete game shutout nonetheless, from Chris Bassitt. I know that Shai Davidi, our colleague for Sportsnet, did a great article up on it after the game and, you know, talked about just how rare it is to see that happen. And now, from anybody, let alone a guy like Chris Bassitt, but he also brought up the point that maybe we underestimate the fact that Bassitt is one of those guys show that might actually be more able to go through a lineup more often, given the fact that he has eight different pitches to work with and can actually show a guy a different pitch sequence his third or fourth time through the lineup.
Yeah, Bassett's not going to be the guy who overwhelms you with pure raw stuff, right? Like, he's closer. If you're looking at like a gauge, the needle is probably closer to a deception type of pitcher than like a blow you away with his stuff kind of pitcher. So it's definitely great that he has all the different pitches to work with. And I always loved how in Major League Baseball, I don't know where you fall on this, Logan, but the idea that there's like the sweeper and the slurve and the ghost ball and the fork ball, and they all have all, like, pitchers have like a zillion different names these days. And I think it's a lot of fun, frankly, and MLB needs that kind of stuff. But Bassitt is one of the few pitchers where I feel like we're not exaggerating when we say he has legitimately seven or eight different kinds of pitches he can deploy at any given time. And you're right, it totally keeps the batters off guard. And I'll give the defense some credit as well for Bassett's complete game shutout, because there were some phenomenal defensive plays made behind him on that diamond, right? Bo Bichette with a diving grab just above the second base bag. Kevin Kiermaier with a sliding grab in the outfield as well for an out. Matt Chapman with a great play where he kind of got the ball right in his gut, stepped on the bag, and made the throw to first across the diamond to complete a double play. And even Alejandro Kirk, and the catching, both for Kirk and Jansen, have not had maybe sustained success keeping runners from moving from bag to bag, although stolen base attempts just across baseball are up this year, so maybe that's not only on them. But he made a great throw in that game to get a runner at third base on a stolen base attempt. So Bassitt has been absolutely phenomenal. I think, too, because he played the majority of his career, Logan, in Oakland, where Oakland has not had a lot of success for a very long time, and it looks like that's going to unfortunately continue this year. But because Bassitt played a lot of his career in Oakland, and then he played some of it, of course, with the Mets and the NL, I feel like there just haven't been a lot of eyeballs on Bassitt. But he's one of those guys you can quietly pencil in for 150-plus innings, and he has always been very quietly reliable. And apart from his first start with the Blue Jays, he's basically been that this throughout this entire year. So great to see him come through with a complete game shutout, the first one since Mark Burley did it in 2015 over nine innings.
I have to admit, it was a cool feeling to see it again, and I'm sure for you who sees the Blue Jays on a more regular basis than we do out here, show, but to see Kevin Pillar come back and still get the kind of reception that he has, clearly still a fan favorite in Toronto, and clearly still a place that he loves visiting. I know he hasn't been there enough. He does go yard against his old team and made it a little bit difficult for them, but still a cool moment to see a guy like that come back who's, you know, obviously had such an impact during his time there. I know he was never a star or an MVP type guy, but those are the guys that you come to appreciate over your years of fandom, and it was really cool to see the reception he got back in Toronto.
Okay, you let me know what this player is for you, but I think Kevin Pillar, for me at least, is definitely up there with those kinds of, because you're right, like, he's not a star necessarily, or wasn't necessarily when he was the starting center fielder for the Blue Jays when they were going to the playoffs those years, but he was the kind of player who embodies, I think, what fans want to see when they go to a game, like not just flashy plays, which you'll get from the, at the time, like the Jose Bautistas or the Josh Donaldsons or whatever, but he kind of embodies that kind of, I don't know, grit and sandpaper, to borrow a term from hockey, a kind of approach from a player. And I think Santiago Espinal, I think, at least maybe not this year, but the last couple of years seemed to be that player for the Blue Jays. Maybe this year it's like a Marchand or someone similar. But I'm curious, like, do you feel that that moniker of like grit and sandpaper could apply to anyone else from those teams? Because Kevin Pillar seemed to embody it perfectly to me. I know that's definitely like a hockey term I'm stealing from here, because everyone loves like the grinder on the fourth line who goes out there and starts fights, for example. People love that kind of stuff. But Kevin Pillar is as close to that kind of player, I think, because he's a kind of lunch pail guy, comes to work, does all the right things, says all the right things, and then you add in some highlight plays on defense as well.
Yeah, it's interesting you put it that way, because I definitely don't know that I see anybody else in that time who fit the same mold as Kevin did. But I always looked at Kevin Pillar, and maybe less so as he's gotten older, but I always looked at Kevin Pillar and went, that's a guy that you can win with in baseball, because he cares so much. You knew he was always going to put it out on the line. He was always such a good team player, even when it, you know, didn't lead to starts in center field. He was always good to move around and do whatever the manager asked of him. I think Kevin Pillar was always just that guy that you could win with, because he was going to fit into a locker room. He was always going to do what was asked of him. And then you add in those points that you made, show about the grit and the heart that the guy had. And I remember, I think, pretty much every time I can think of any Jays bench-clearing brawl during his time, I think Kevin Pillar was one of the first guys out there. Now, he's the fastest, which is probably half of the reason he was out there, but the other half was because he just loves his team so much, he was always willing to go and do whatever it mattered. That's how I always thought of Kevin Pillar.
Yeah, he definitely, for me, like, is emblematic to a certain degree. Like, certainly, like, the guys you think of, like the Russell Martins and Bautistas and Ed Encarnacion and stuff, like, obviously you're going to think of those guys first. But at the same time, yeah, I think Kevin Pillar did embody that next kind of player who's, like, not necessarily a star, but still, I think, endears himself to fans for a lot of the reasons you mentioned. You know who else came to mind as you were saying that? Ryan Goins. I think, like, that's Ryan Goins is probably another guy who kind of falls into that same category. But, no, it was really cool to see Kevin Pillar come back. And he was probably like the worst or the best possible case scenario, right? He hits a home run at the Rogers Center, gets a great round of applause when he first comes up to the plate. Even when he went out to the left field, the people in the seats just above the left field bullpen, they got out of their seats and they gave him a standing ovation. And then he got a bigger ovation from the larger crowd when he was hit a home run, and the Jays still won. So it was probably the best case scenario, I'd say.
Absolutely. Show Ali along with the show. I got to ask you, for John Schneider, is there a better situation right now than having Bo Bichette, Matt Chapman, and Vladimir Guerrero all sitting in the top five when it comes to average in the American League, and all of them hitting over .310 right now? I know that that's probably unsustainable and tough to ask right now, but when you talk about the heart of the Jays lineup and those three guys specifically hitting as well as they have early on this season, how important is that to what the Jays want to do?
Oh, yeah, hugely important, right? Like, they are the guys that, to borrow the Bo Jackson term, right? Like, they're the straw that stirs the drink for the Blue Jays. I think maybe Matt Chapman has been so phenomenal over the course of the season, and we'll see if that, like you're using the word unsustainable, we'll see if that is sustainable to a certain degree. The way he is hitting the ball makes you feel like it probably is, based on his, even if he's not hitting it, he's still getting on base at a great clip. So I'll definitely include him in that conversation. But Bo, Vladdy, and Chapman have been, like you're saying, some of the best hitters in all of baseball early on. And I honestly think, and I know the way the Philly game ended wasn't great for Bo Bichette because of the errant throw. They lose because of the throwing error from effectively from second to first. But Bo Bichette has been, I think, on the whole, a much better defender this year than he has been certainly even last year. And if Bo Bichette is even an average, a league average defender, then when you add in what he brings in offensively at the plate, I mean, good heavens, this is a guy you're probably talking about being in the contention for maybe American League MVP. And I mean, it's going to be hard to, especially with those guys in Los Angeles, it's going to be hard to dethrone Mike Trout, who's still, even when he's slumping, is still one of the best players, not even on planet Earth, but just in the history of the sport. And then, of course, oh, yeah, some guy named Shohei Ohtani, who's probably always going to be like top three in MVP voting. But if Bo keeps this up, even to a little bit of a degree, and he can keep on being an average defender, I think you'll hear a lot more MVP chants the next time he comes to the plate.
Joel will be along with us from Sportsnet 590, The Fan in Toronto. I can hear him on Jays Talk and, of course, on the Jays pregame show as well. Interesting series coming up against the Yankees starting tonight's show, and obviously a lot of people still focusing on Alek Manoah and trying to get his season back to where he wants it to be. How important would it be, or how nice would it be, I guess, for the Jays to see a more classic Alek Manoah-type start tonight against the Yankees?
Oh, my gosh, it would be great. Wouldn't it be great if you could just tell Alek Manoah that he plays the Yankees every single time?
Because yes.
for whatever reason, he seems to just dominate the Yankees, whether it's in New York or in Toronto. So I am hoping for a good start for him. And I'm also hoping that maybe he can get some run support as well, because the Yankees, last I checked, this was yesterday, last I checked, it was a TBA starter. I think their plans are, based on what I've seen on Twitter and so on, that they're going to have an opener in Jimmy Cordero and then probably have someone do a bulk, kind of like a bulk reliever role, whether it's Johnny Brito or someone else, we'll see, but probably Brito because he's done that before. But if that's the case, like if those are the guys the Yankees are rolling out because they don't have Luis Severino, they don't have Carlos Rodon, then you would think that the dangerous lineup, we just talked about Bo and Chapman and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and so on, you would think that these guys can give Alek Manoah some run support. The Yankees still have a decent bullpen, even though they are towards the bottom half of the AL East right now. So given that for the rest of the series, you're going to see, I believe it's Domingo Herman, Gerrit Cole, and Nestor Cortes Jr. for the rest of this four-game set after today, I think you want to be able to take advantage of an Alek Manoah start as much as humanly possible. It'll be a great bounce-back spot for him if he's able to get right. It's still a team in New York that, you know, there's no Giancarlo Stanton. He's still working his way back from that injury. Yes, Aaron Judge is back, and he did just hit two home runs in a game where Shane McClanahan started that game, so who is probably the presumptive, at least for now, AL Cy Young front runner. So still a dangerous lineup. Don't get me wrong, but it would be nice to see Alek Manoah bounce back. And we know he can because we've seen the body of work over a couple of years. So even if there was some regression due for Manoah, he is so talented that even against the Yankees, I think, especially at home, he probably is due for a good start.
I know we just talked about Manoah and you know, the 1-3 record so far. And I know Gausman is having a good year, despite, you know, he hasn't got a couple decisions himself. But I would have to admit, when I think about this, and John Schneider would probably have to admit, too, it's been a pretty good start so far, all things considered, given how many questions we had about this starting five heading into the year. And I know Kikuchi's been good. He ends up with that one. It wasn't great on the weekend, but, you know, manages to come out of it on top, and everything's good there. But all the things we talked about last year's show about this team overworking their bullpen, you know, having to go to them too many times, the questions about the marks here. I know it hasn't been perfect, and you'd love to see Manoah pitching more at that ace level like we just talked about, but you have to be pretty damn happy with what you've gotten out of these five guys so far this season, right?
Oh, yeah. I think after the first maybe two turns of the starting rotation, maybe even like 1.5 turn, because certainly the first turn of the rotation, apart from Kevin Gausman, was pretty good, I would say. But then, pretty not great, I should say. Then they turned it around after the first turn, and they've gotten consistently better since. Manoah has been the only one who has largely struggled in more of his starts than not, unfortunately. And he was good in a handful of them, especially against the Yankees, like we're talking about. But, yeah, I mean, what you've gotten out of Chris Bassitt, we were talking about the complete game shutout earlier, every single start since he got rocked against the Cardinals in the opening series of the season, he has gotten better virtually every start. Even in the start before the complete game shutout, he went 7 innings and didn't allow a run. That's pretty darn good. You'll take that 10 out of 10 times. Jose Berrios definitely can be a little Jekyll and Hyde, but you know, when you look at his splits on the home and at home and on the road, he definitely is more Mr. Jekyll, which is good, I guess, at the Rogers Center than Mr. Hyde on the road. But even on the road, his past five games have been, the start in Boston notwithstanding, have been pretty darn good as well. You mentioned it with Kikuchi. Yesterday was easily his worst start of the season, but coming into yesterday's game, he had been so consistent. He looks more dominant, especially when he's throwing fastballs in the strike zone. Looks more willing to throw the fastball as well than last year when he was very slider happy. And then I'm not even sure we need to talk about much about Kevin Gausman, because outside of that maybe like three specific innings, he has been one of the best pitchers in baseball, right? So I'm totally with you. Alec Manoah can turn it around. We'll be talking about this rotation like we were going to talk about it in the offseason, which is there's a lot of potential, but there's a, you know, when you talk about teams and their hierarchy in the AL, this is one of the better rotations in the American League.
And last one before I let you go, we have a couple different people we talk baseball with here on the station, and you know, from a more league-wide perspective, it's always interesting to me, and it's not like it's anything new. The American League East has for a long time been one of the better divisions in baseball show, but I'm just curious from a Toronto perspective, especially knowing that you're talking about a team that's 12-3 at home, 24 wins on the season. By most accounts, they would be first or second in any other division except for the AL East. It feels like it's going to be another one of those years where you're going to have to deal with it throughout the season. Yes, the Rays have a good lead on everybody right now, but it feels like there isn't going to be a series or a day off when it comes to teams matching up in the AL East.
No, it's true. And I mean, this is a division where, like you're saying, every single team is over 500. I don't know if that's going to stay the case by the end of the regular season. But I mean, if Boston had a down year last year and they're still pretty darn good this year, they still have to get a couple guys back from injury. So they're a dangerous squad. The Yankees, you always know they're going to be dangerous regardless of the injuries or a down year. The Orioles have an extremely young squad, so we'll see if that's sustainable. But still, they are 26-14 and are ahead of the Jays in the AL East. It is kind of wild that if you took the Jays and put them into literally any other division, they would be tied for first, in first outright, or at, like maybe a handful of games behind second place instead of being six games back of the Rays right now. I still do think the Rays are probably not like 738 winning percentage good, because there's probably no team that's good. But the Blue Jays, given that they are 24-16 through 40 games, that's good for one of the best regular seasons in all of Blue Jays history, franchise history, when you extrapolate it out over a full 162. So I think you're definitely happy with the start, and you just hope that maybe regression comes for the Rays to a certain degree. And I think it will over the course of 162, but it's still going to be a dogfight. Much like the Yankees got off to a terrific start in 2022, the Rays have gotten off to another historic start in 2023. So the Jays are certainly talented to catch up or to keep pace, but it does mean they can't take their foot off the gas pedal. You're right.
Going to be interesting. It starts playing against the Yankees and continues on this homestand against the Baltimore Orioles. Show, appreciate the time. As always, thanks for hopping on with us, man. Have a great broadcast tonight. We'll chat with you again soon, hey?
Yeah, you have my number. Call me anytime. I'll talk to you anytime, Logan.
Appreciate that, man. Thank you. Joe Ali joining us from the Sportsnet 590 The Fan station in Toronto. Pre-game for the Jays, post-game and Jays talk. You know, you've called in and chatted with the show plenty of times. You can find him on Twitter at SNS Ali, all things Toronto Blue Jays. And yes, the Jays opening up a series against the New York Yankees tonight. Alec Manoah gets the start for the Jays. We'll take you out to New York, or to Toronto for a 5 o'clock start tonight before we head out to Coachella Valley for the Wranglers and the Firebirds. So lots of sports on your radios tonight. We got the PDO cast with Dmitry Filipovich coming up next. Flames talk with Steinberg at 4, and then yes, Yankees Jays at 5, 8 o'clock. Wranglers and Firebirds with Sandra Priscina on the call for game 3 of the Pacific Division Final. And on your televisions tonight, Stars and Kraken game 7. Winner goes on to take on the Vegas Golden Knights in round 3 of the Stanley Cup playoffs. We have so much going on tonight. We'll be back tomorrow to break it all down. Thanks to Show Ali and to Reed Wilkins for joining us as guests today. Thank you for listening, whether live on the pod or on the podcast. And thank you to outstanding producers Cam and Taylor for another great show. We'll be back tomorrow to break it all down right here. Same time, same place. Sportsnet 960 The Fan.